Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good morning. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Max Votolato, talking about his new book called Gardena Poker Clubs, A High Stakes History. Max Votolato was born in London and now works in the Los Angeles area for the film industry. His initial research into the card clubs in Gardena was for a documentary called Freeway City, which may be watched for free on Vimeo. Max Votolato, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Pleasure to be here.
How did you happen to get interested in Gardena, the freeway city, which led to the documentary and later the book?
Initially, I came to Los Angeles in 2001, and Freeway City came on the heels of I was making a documentary film about the local bail bonds industry in Los Angeles, which led me to Gardena. One of the bail bondsmen I was profiling is a Gardena local and grew up in the city, and in shadowing him, I was spending a lot of time in Gardena, particularly at his sort of off-duty headquarters, which was a bar on Gardena Boulevard, a very old bar that's been there for, as long as the city nearly, called the Desert Room. And it's a very interesting place. You have a lot of people from different generations that frequent there. And so through, spending the time inside that bar on a regular basis, I really met the community, and I was starting to hear all of these, amazing stories about, really the history of the city of Gardena, things that, you wouldn't know just visiting the town now. The history of the card clubs in particular was fascinating. And my attention started to grow there. I ended up, not finishing the Bail Bonds documentary and diving into Freeway City, deciding that was, a very special story because it was a history of Los Angeles that I had never heard of. And it turned out that, even Angelenos that had grown up in Los Angeles don't know that story. I was working at Paramount Pictures at the time, and I would, talk about this at the lunch table with my colleagues, and, I'd be, telling them the stories, people that were from LA, and they'd say, we never knew this. And, I think it's the greatest story ever told, personally. But I mean, it was great source material and a terrific American story, and really the story of Los Angeles. I think, particularly, in regard to the card club outside of Hollywood, that was the place to be, and that was what was going on. So that film ended up being a 10-year endeavor, and I've put it out on the internet. It's been seen nearly 10,000 times at this point, so it's been, a terrific success, and I feel like, that film really found an audience and has, fans, not only from Gardena but beyond. So it was great to have that film seen, and that film actually, resulted in the book deal for Gardena Poker Clubs. So.
Was part of what drew you to it, I mean, did you have an interest in poker or gambling in general, or you were just interested in the story?
I was an outsider. I mean, I knew about the clubs that were in Gardena, starting, with me being there in 2001. That was, the Hustler Casino had just opened, and I'd been there, just to kind of check it out, and I'd been to the Normandy Club, Normandy Casino at that time. So I knew those places. I wasn't, a player really. I'd go with friends that played, and, being in Gardena, you're always kind of around that scene that there's that, that's the attraction down there. So I've been to those places, but I was drawn in by the history and the events that surrounded those clubs, the people, all of it is what drew me in.
Now, I read your book, Gardena Poker Clubs, primarily because you sent Richard and me copies to review.
Yeah.
Now, frankly, we get a lot of books to review, and many don't make it to the podcast. I dipped into this one because I was raised in Gardena. My parents moved there 3 months after I was born in 1947, and we had a three-bedroom, one-bathroom house that cost $99.95, a little less than $10,000.
Amazing.
They moved out 19 years later during the White Flight that took place after the 1965 Watts riot that scared the hell out of them. Since I remember our family eating dinner at the Monterey Club and the Rainbow Club several times when I was a boy, I was interested in reading more about what happened. I wrote a review of the book and noticed that several of my readers had experience with Gardena. So maybe there was enough interest to justify having you on the podcast. So here we are. There's a lot to the Gardena history that has nothing to do with card clubs. But since this is a gambling-oriented show, we're going to stick mainly to the gambling aspects. So when did legalized poker come to Gardena? And how come it arose in Gardena and nowhere else in California?
Well, it's a really – it's an interesting story. I mean, it goes back into the early 1930s is really where it kind of picks up for Gardena poker clubs. Ernie Prim, who is, you know, famously known as the godfather of the Gardena poker clubs, he was born in Texas, but he grew up in Hollywood, California. He went to Hollywood High, and his father was a, you know, former oil man who ran a confectionery in Hollywood, you know, a candy store. And Prim, out of high school, was an entrepreneur and had a little cafe of his own. And then at some point, you know, ventured off into the concrete jungle of downtown Los Angeles at, you know, early 1930s. And you got to, you know a little bit about 1930s Los Angeles was a bastion of corruption and vice. They described it. You know, there was a mayor who was elected, who was a Canadian-born mayor. His name was Frank Shaw. And he basically turned City Hall in Los Angeles into his own private piggy bank and was selling city jobs. Him and his brother Joe, you know, you could pay them and get on the police force or the fire department or any of the, you know, municipal services. They figured out ways to make money out of everything. And they also made money off the streets because they turned a blind eye to all the vice that was going on. So, you know, gambling clubs were frequent, you know, all the way through downtown and parts of, you know, West Los Angeles, Glendale. There's all sorts of notable clubs, which they called at the time speaks, as in speakeasies. You know, although they weren't legal, they weren't being busted. LAPD, sheriffs, people that were in law enforcement, you know, often, you know, hung out at these places and probably, you know, profited off of them in ways. So the city was turning a blind eye. And this, you know, Shaw started in 1933. And then as time went on, there was his brother got into trouble. You know, a lot of reformism started to get very popular, and there was a reformist movement led by a cafeteria owner, a famous you know, guy who had a cafeteria in downtown Los Angeles named, you know, Clifton, and they organized a recall of Frank Shaw. He was the first big city American mayor to be recalled from office, and this went down in 1937. He was replaced by a reformist mayor named Bowron, and Bowron came in and wanted to clean up the town, and so all of this vice that was going on, you know, basically had to flee from LA to escape the jaws of reform, as it were. So Prim and his partner Frankie Martin, who was a wealthy guy from Northern California and really, you know, bankrolled a lot of Prim's early enterprises. During the Shaw administration, they ran an illegal club in downtown Los Angeles called the Edgemont Club. the Edgemont Club was located above a coffin factory, and it was a popular place. One story I heard about the Edgemont Club is that at the time, their employee, a man named Russ Miller, who you know, he's famous in Gardena as the owner of the Normandy Club, he started out working for Ernie Prim and Frankie Martin as a bouncer, sort of a doorman who regulated who could come in and out of this Edgemont Club. One night, people were in the club playing, and this wasn't just a card club. This was a real illegal casino. They had craps and roulette and, you know, all sorts of games there. A police captain who was well known to the doormen and everybody that worked at the club just came in for, you know, a nightly visit. And everybody that was at the tables playing saw this cop coming in, and they thought the club was being raided. They all ran for the exits and ran out of the place. So they eventually promoted Russ Miller to Bucksman on the craps table after that. But, you know, the trio, Prim, Martin, and Miller kind of, you know, the writing was on the wall for them in a sense. So they, you know, prior to the recall of Frank Shaw, they decided to take their rogue, you know, gambling operation 15 miles south to what was this very sleepy farming town, Gardena, a town of 3,000 people. And the reasons for them going there are, you know, that Prim had a relationship with the town's first mayor. Gardena was incorporated in 1930, and there was a man named Wayne Bogart who was elected the first mayor. He ran an automobile agency, and somehow Prim knew Bogart and decided to set up shop in Gardena. Gardena was before that time famous as the berry capital of Southern California. It was a big agricultural community and located right off a rail line that would take produce into downtown and surrounding areas. So it was all about agriculture there. But the berry crops had dwindled since the First World War. They'd switched over to other crops to help the war effort. So they weren't as prosperous as they had been at one time. So when Prim and his partners came in and they proposed some sort of a gambling ordinance for games of skill in the summer of 36, the city went along with it. They granted them a legal skill game license, and they took over what had been a movie theater, a theater called the Embassy Theater on Vermont. And it was an old Art Deco building that was, I believe it was defunct when they took it over. They did a $20,000 renovation, which is about $350,000 in today's money. And they redid this building and opened it up as the Embassy Palace Club. And the first offerings that they had there were surrounding a game called Skillo, not poker actually. Skillo was a game where you take a ball and you're given a box with a rows of little boxes with numbers on them, and you have to hit a sequence of predetermined numbers. So it's a skill game, throwing balls. I think they had checkers and chess and things like that. They still ran the illegal side of their operation in Gardena outside of this Embassy Palace Club. There was a place called the F&O Confectionery, another candy store that sort of in the vein of Prim's father's candy store in Hollywood. But it was a front for an illegal casino. And again, Russ Miller was responsible for manning the counter at this candy store with his henchmen. And they would, you know, regulate, you know, who could come in and out of the actual casino and, you know, probably chase off anybody that was there to buy candy. One funny story about them was that, you know, after spending long hours minding the shop, Miller and his guys, you know, ate the candy that Prim had bought to kind of dress the place as a prop to make it look like a legitimate, you know, candy store. So they would tear little bits of cardboard up and wrap them in the wax wrappers and restock them. And one day Prim came in and he was checking on the place and he wanted some candy, and they told him it had all gone stale because they were trying to cover up for the fact they'd ate it all. But the F&O confectionery was making about, you know, I heard one estimate, $15,000 a month. So, you know, lots of money. And then, you know, even though the city had given the Embassy Palace license to operate, it didn't last long because the local law enforcement, you know, came and closed them down. There was a pushback, and F&O confectionery was raided. They had a billiard, a pool hall on Gardena Boulevard called the Gardena Billiard Parlor. There was card games going on in there that Prim was running, and that got busted. So it all went away for a short time. And that had to do with members of the community who kind of, you know, got wise to what was going on there. There was some outside pressure. And go ahead, sorry.
Well, whenever there's poker clubs in a city, that's always going to be a political decision. There were some colorful political battles along the way as to whether or not to allow the poker clubs. Can you tell us some of those?
Yeah. starting with the law enforcement who were kind of busting up Prim's original operations, they shut down the Embassy Palace and by forcing those ordinances into court, and they got a local judge after several goes to rule that Skill-O was not just a game of skill but also a game of chance. That happened in 1938. So they closed the club, and that would have been, you know, community members and law enforcement who were not happy that the city was licensing these games. But there's another step in 1938. Prim has this kind of, I would say, like near biblical discovery for himself, which is he was at a Santa Monica bingo parlor, and that bingo parlor was openly operating commercial draw poker. And this is after he'd been shut down in, you know, by the sheriff in Gardena, you know, just, you know, some months after that. So he's going to the proprietor, how can you guys be doing this and no one's, you know, busting it up? And the proprietor said to Prim, read the law. It doesn't say in that law and the legislator that poker is illegal. So Prim goes and tracks down the 1872 statute that outlawed gambling in California and discovered it was true. It didn't list draw. It didn't list poker. It was a situation where senators who wrote that original law, they played poker and they didn't want to put themselves in a situation where they put themselves out of the game. So they listed every other gambling game you could imagine on the California legislators, the outlawed games, but they left the word poker off the list. And I mean, this legislator actually underwent a few revisions in 1911. The Attorney General U.S. Webb published an opinion on the that poker was exempted from the list because it was a game of skill and science and not a game of chance. So,
but wasn't there some distinction made between draw poker and stud poker? Because I remember hold'em was not legal until, I think it was the 80s when finally they were able to start dealing stud and hold'em.
Stud was listed on this legislator as an outlawed game, but draw wasn't because the cards were dealt face down. So that was the distinction. And so the in 38, in June that year, Frankie Martin goes to the Gardena City Council with this, you know, armed with this information, and he gets them to agree to grant the Embassy Palace a new license, this time to operate draw poker. And the city would get yearly surcharges from each table in the club, and the club opened up, you know, with 40 tables. So it was an instant success, and they, you know, were generating a lot of revenue for the city. But, you know, again, they get shuttered in 39, and they're being ruled in court as a public nuisance. So it wasn't an easy thing. I you know, I go back to, you know, the you know, how powerful the opposing forces in the community were to some of this. You know, there were these church groups that really felt that there was a moral decay of standards, that standards were crumbling because Gardena was home to you know, this club and then the others that followed, you know. So they had a lot of pushback, but you know, the club was shut down by early 39, so again, it didn't last long. But Prim took the fight to the courts, knowing that draw poker was in fact, you know, legal, and he had a lawyer that who became another partner, a guy named Sammy Rummel, who's name shows up a lot, you know, in LA history, because he was also Mickey Cohen's lawyer. So he kind of moved in a lot of, you know, the underworld circles and represented some really big players in LA at the time. By 1940,
we have lawyers like that, and we make them the mayor.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't too far off in Gardena by the time, you know, Prim got, you know, his legitimacy back. You know, in 1941, Prim and Rummel went to the District Court of Appeals, and, you know, they're fighting to get Prim's club, the Monterey, his little poker license reinstated. They had opened that club, I believe, in 40, because the city started issuing skill game licenses again that summer, 1940. So there was, you know, kind of the city was really always in favor of this because of the revenue they could make. There's another court case where Rummel cites this Municipal Corporations Act of 1935, which became really key into getting the clubs their status. And this Municipal Corporations Act stated that any ordinance passed by a city within the scope of its own authority had the same force within city limits as a statute passed by the legislation throughout the state. So they had this trial where after the club being branded as a public nuisance, they bring in this cast of characters from like a who's who of Gardena to the courthouse to all talk about what a credit to the community the Monterey Club is, and they won. And so by 1942, there's now 6,000 people living in Gardena, and the city's limited clubs to every 1,500 persons of population. They've got the Embassy, the Monterey, the Western, and the Gardena clubs. And, you know, 3 years later, there's six clubs. I go back and talk about the, you know, the push from the ministerial leaders. There was a group of local church leaders in 45 who branded themselves the Gardena Ministerial Association. They were a collective of church group leaders, and they led a crowd of 300 churchgoers into a Gardena City Council meeting one night, urging them to repeal gaming laws. And they were powerful. They got, you know, their issue on the ballot for April 1946. They wanted to abolish the card clubs. There was, you know, some really big church group meetings that took place in, you know, the end of 1945. There's one where 150 people attended to listen to local reverends and pastors, and they had to, you know, level with their people and say, hey, look, you know, we want to get rid of these clubs because of, you know, what they do to the reputation and the morals of the city. But the trade-off is that there's going to be a tax hike, and that's, you know, where support often wavers, because, you know, property taxes were very low. They were being offset by the revenues generated by all those clubs.
Jesus doesn't care anymore.
Right. You know, they even, you know, they're bandied about, like, there was one guy saying, you know, if we can't make it on our own, you know, in terms of, you know, the tax money that the clubs are giving us, maybe we should disincorporate the city of Gardena and just return it to, you know, County of LA property, just to restore the moral fabric. There's one guy named Dr. Eatseth, a Presbyterian pastor who talked about the trinity of evil. I always remember this. He says, you know, the trinity of evil is brought about by gambling, and the trinity is gambling, liquor, and prostitution. Let one get a hold and automatically bring the other two with it. Well, he might have been onto something, but that was the fear. And these local ministers were really preaching about how Gardena had this kind of fork in the road future, where it could be a place for business, or a place that was known as a red light district for gambling. But, you know, the following April, they lost the vote quite, you know, one-sided. There was a, you know, 1097 to 1522 vote, you know, pro card club groups really dominated, with economic and taxation concerns trumping the religious moral concerns of the community. So there was always this battle. This was the first big battle, but this went on and on, and kind of repeated over and over the years, in terms of, you know, support for abolishing the clubs because of what, you know, it was thought that they were doing to the community, not just on a moral level, but it was also thought that they were stunting the growth of the community, that, you know, businesses like department stores that were, you know, national chains wouldn't come into Gardena because of the reputation the city had as a place for gambling. So that was the trade-off. And as a countermeasure, Prim became not just an owner, but kind of a very respected businessman in the community. Like you say, he had to, you know, keep them on his side, because the voters were vital for the survival of the clubs. Every time someone had an objection, it would end up on the ballot. So in order to, you know, win the support of the community, who was very, you know, skeptical, these were, you know, kind of small town people initially, you know, from a farming community, and the customers that came to the clubs weren't Gardena locals necessarily. I think, you know, they talk about how Beverly Hills and the West Side, a lot of wealthy middle class doctors and lawyers, people like that, housewives from, you know, middle class families would come play there. And that was the bread and butter of these clubs. The locals mainly used the clubs, like you say, as a restaurant. They had cheap meals to keep, you know, the gamblers there. You could get a very nice dinner there for, you know, very little money, and they were, you know, very elegant clubs too, so it was nice to go there. That's how the locals you know, knew the clubs mainly, unless they were card players too. But Prim, you know, ran Christmas dinner drives and donated a teen recreation center to the city, the city's first. He donated the city's first swimming pool. And somehow over the years, every local organization benefited in one way or another from, you know, financial aid from the clubs. So they were, you know, always concerned about public relations. That was a big part of surviving Gardena.
How are the card clubs of the 50s and 60s different from the way poker rooms are found today in Las Vegas and elsewhere?
Well, I mean, I talked about how they were elegant. They had a lot of sophistication. I mean, the clientele being, you know, wealthy or upper middle class. And in a lot of cases, I think, you know, people dressed up to come play at these clubs, and you know, players dealt the games themselves was one, you know, thing. And, they're also, you know, they were quite restricted in terms of, you know, there was no liquor. You couldn't comp anybody in a club like that because of the strict ordinances. And the city had very strict ordinances just because, you know, they were always on eggshells about the legality of everything. So you couldn't give a cup of coffee away in Gardena to customers because that might, you know, give your club an edge over another club, an illegal edge. So no comps. They didn't have as many games. They played, you know, draw, low ball. Now, they play many more games at the clubs. The clubs had chip girls who were, you know, kind of hostesses who served cigarettes and coffee sandwiches and Coca-Cola, just very basic amenities. And they took a collection on the hour, the half hour, to keep everybody in their seat. You rented your seat. The card clubs, because they couldn't have liquor, you know, every card club had a very nearby neighboring bar where players could kind of quickly run away to get a drink between hands. And a friend of mine told me a story about a guy named Ray Mangarum, who's was a golf pro. He was the older brother of a more famous golf pro named Lloyd Mangarum. And Ray Mangarum played at the Normandy. He had got it down to a science where, you know, between hands, he could get up from his chair, hit the crossing light at the, you know, right outside the club, cross over the street to the bar across the street. The bartender knew him by face, poured his drink, he had a shot. He'd take a shot, go back across the street, get back into his chair before the next hand, and he knew how to time it perfectly. So, you know, that he was a regular.
Nowadays, they run out to smoke, you know, because of the smoking ban there now.
Right, right.
People are constantly running out to smoke, although they've found some clever ways of being allowed to smoke while playing by building these quote-unquote outdoor facilities that aren't really, you would never know that you were outdoors.
Well, you could definitely smoke in the old Gardena clubs. You know, I've heard stories about how there was, you know, the Normandy famously had, you know, quite low ceilings, and there'd be this cloud of cigarette smoke just accumulated from all of the players all day, you know, all night smoking. And the Miller family, they talked about how, you know, when Dad would come home after a day on the floor, he just had to take his clothes off at the front door because he smelled so bad coming into the house from standing in cigarettes all day. You know, it's like, so
cigars as well,
I'm sure. Yeah. Anything to keep people playing.
Now, the games in Gardena were dealt by the players, so cheating was not unknown. How big of a problem was this, and what did the clubs do about it?
Cheating was a huge problem in Gardena, a very big problem, and was often, you know, quite sophisticated, where you had cheaters who worked in teams and then would, you know, split up afterwards. You know, they'd meet up afterwards to split the money that they'd cheated the other players at the table out of by using, you know, say, secret signals that only they knew to tell each other what kind of cards they had or things like that. Clubs had to do all sorts of elaborate things to try to catch these cheaters because they were difficult to catch. So every club had a hidden system of gangways in the attic area above the ceiling of the gaming floor. And on these gangways, there were teams of floor men who would go up there and be spotters. They'd take turns with binoculars and special telescopes that they could look through little portholes in the ceilings and spy down on the games using these, you know, little optical telescopes to look for improprieties in the gameplay. Some of these telescopes, by the way, were really sophisticated, like where they could get down to, you know, a player's manicure in the focus of the lens, so they could really see what everybody was holding, and they'd watch for hours, see what people were doing, the patterns, because a cheater was thought to be the worst thing that could happen in a card club, because it turns your good customers away, and people that feel like they're being cheated will get up and leave. They won't stay and spend the money to be there. So getting rid of the cheaters and policing them and then once they were figured out, banning them was a real priority, and they always wanted to do this without letting the rest of the straight crowd know who the cheaters were. So sometimes once somebody had been revealed as a cheater through the portholes in the ceiling, the word would go down, the chair the guy was sitting in, and the floorman might make eye contact with the guy and send him a signal, like kind of brush his arm off or something and say, hey, you're no good in here anymore, get out, don't come back. And the cheaters generally knew what those signs meant, because they'd probably been kicked out of, many clubs before, because once you were banned in one club, you just went, across the street to the next one and played. So those spotters were real important. And, of course, later on, they were replaced by closed circuit TV systems and became even more sophisticated. There's a great story from the Normandy Club about how one time they caught a guy who was wearing a homemade holdout device that was very sophisticated. It was made out of dental tools, and he wore it under his clothing, and it had to do with tapping his leg under the table, and had slick sleeves, so he, like kind of almost like the guns in Taxi Driver, sleeves that he could have little rods on to pull cards back and forth out of his sleeve. So this guy had spent a tremendous amount of money crafting this thing, and it took him a long time. And when they caught him and took him in the back and had him undressed, they discovered, said they were amazed at this thing he was wearing, and they took it off him. And they of course he was banned from the club, but he begged profusely to have this holdout kit back, because it was so elaborate. And he said, I'll never even play in California again, just give me my gear back. And they wouldn't. They said, no, you're banned. And they kept it, as a memento. It's actually until the club it changed hands, it was up in the family office on the second floor, and they had it in a picture frame. There's a picture of it in my book. It was pretty impressive. Another thing that they did to combat cheaters was Tom Parks, who worked at the Gardena and Horseshoe Clubs and later managed the Rainbow Club, talked about how he brought in experts from Hollywood's Magic Castle, which is the Academy of Magical Arts in Los Angeles, to help work out, some of the trickery that was going on the floor. He said, we knew who the cheaters were, but it was so hard to prove what they were actually doing. We needed help sometimes. So they brought in these experts that knew about, card play to help, figure out what the cons were.
All right. We're talking to Max Votolato, author of Gardena Poker Clubs, A High Stakes History. We're going to take a brief break for some commercial messages, and then we'll be returned to Max in a few moments.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. If you've been collecting the twice-a-week free play in October, make sure you stop by this coming Monday, October 30th, to collect your double payout. In November, the month-long promotion involves half-price Smith's $50 gift cards. Normally $50 in cash or free play is earned by playing 16,667 points. In November, if you earn half that, namely 8,334 points, you get the gift card. Those points must be earned and redeemed in November. There's a limit of 10 gift cards per person. On Thanksgiving Day, there will be a hot seat promotion where 320 times during the day, somebody who's playing is going to get $100 free play. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Super Draw 6-Card Poker. This is a 10 coins per line game where you're dealt the normal 5 cards, But after you make your hold, in addition to giving you the cards to fill in whatever you threw away, you also received a sixth card for each line. There are extra pay schedule categories, namely six-card royal flushes, six-card straight flushes, six-card regular flushes, four of a kind plus a pair, two three-of-a-kinds in the same hand, and three pair. To figure this all out, you need to create your own software, as currently available commercial software does not include this game.
Okay, Max Fotolotto. Every card club opening in Gardena incurred political discussion, but none more so than when Larry Flint, prominent pornographer, among other things, wanted to build the Hustler Casino. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Hustler Casino was formerly the El Dorado Club, and it was owned by a man named George Anthony and the Anthony family. They took over that club in 1968. They acquired the club and the license from a Beverly Hills businessman named Warren Blank. Warren had taken the original Embassy Club and done a massive renovation on the structure, turning the original, you know, Art Deco club that had formerly been a movie theater, it's just the same original club that the Gardena started with, and he refashioned it as this, you know, incredible Spanish colonial revival style building with, you know, amazing topiary. There's pictures of the club online, even, like, you can see it looked completely different. But all they did really is re-stucco it and re-roof it, and they gave it, you know, a new branding as the El Dorado Club, and it was a very successful club. But, you know, as time wore on, I believe George Anthony had Alzheimer's when he got older, and he tried to do some pretty revolutionary things for Gardena with the El Dorado Club, where he wanted to build a massive hotel, and later the idea grew into kind of a hotel convention center that would have been adjacent to the original club and would have been like the biggest business and resort, you know, edifice in all of Gardena. Really would have transformed the town. There was renderings of this massive, almost like a skyscraper standing in the middle of suburbia that was going to be built on the lot. And none of it ever came off. Every time he tried to set it up, the ventures failed. And actually, it drove the club into bankruptcy in the end. They were owing the city back taxes. They had floated some municipal bonds to the club that were used to build a parking garage that was also never built. So they drove themselves into debt, and then, you know, the whole thing kind of sadly folded. A former employee of the El Dorado, a woman named Maggie Mundet, you know, knew that the club was in trouble, and she sent out two letters in the mail to one went to Merv Griffin, the game show guru, and the other to Larry Flint. She just thought they'd be great guys to come in and run the El Dorado. And so she wanted to make them aware of this business opportunity that was arising in Gardena. Well, but Merv never responded, so the rest is kind of history, because Larry Flint did. And Larry Flint was a poker player and had always wanted to, you know, own a club like that. So he seized the opportunity, and he got into a bidding war with the Miller family, who owned the Normandy, and also a businessman from Century City in L.A. named Bill Fleischman. And he outbid everybody else, you know, heavily, and ultimately won the bid. But the city was, you know, really worried about, you know, Flint because of his reputation as a publisher of Hustler magazine. And they, you know, thought that he was going to, you know, build an adult club as part of his card club. So it took a lot of convincing. And this is like a, you know, a whole other chapter in Gardena, where, you know, the community was, you know, very divided about, you know, hey, this guy's going to bring in a lot of money and save the club. And, but at the same time, the trade-off is, you know, he's a pornographer. So it's like, very controversial. And, after winning the bid and the license and buying the property outright, he decided to tear down the El Dorado, which was standing on the southern end of what is the parking lot of today's Hustler Casino. And he built the Hustler Club, a, you know, very modern club with a, like a big smoking atrium in the middle and amazing furnishings, very decadent. Anybody who's ever been to the Hustler Club, knows they have, TV screens on every wall and, it's chandeliers and replica Klimt paintings. It's pretty amazing. He wanted to bring the feeling of Las Vegas to Southern California. I mean, I talked to him and he'd say, when I first started going to card clubs in Southern California, they're primarily card clubs, and they sort of have that stigma about them. They're not Vegas. They don't have the flair, even when they're trying to. So he wanted to do it right, and so he poured a lot of money into having this. The building's incredible. It looks like a crown and has neon portholes that kind of light up when you drive by it at night. It's very eye-catching. That was the first, big way to win over the community was a beautiful club. But then the city wanted him to go with the original club name, the El Dorado. They were hoping he would call it the New El Dorado. But they learned quickly from their city attorney that they didn't have a leg to stand on in sort of dictating what the name of this business could be. And, of course, he wanted to call it the Hustler Casino because, of the Hustler brand name being so well known in the landscape of LA County card clubs and how competitive that is. He needed the edge to sort of stand out from the crowd. So they wanted everybody to know it was the Hustler Club. And they ultimately opened the club in 2000. And thing I learned recently was, when they built the club, he installed outlets on the floor in rows and little markers because he intended for the club to have rows of slot machines, even though they're not legal in California, except for Indian tribal grounds. The card clubs can't have slots. That's one of the big distinctions. So he was hoping that he was going to win that fight. And in 2003, we had a recall of the California governor, Gray Davis. And it was kind of a media circus of all the celebrities and who's who decided to put their name in the hat and run for governor. And Larry Flint got on that train and he ran for governor mainly, he says to raise awareness and bring attention to Prop 1A, which was this provision that, gave Native American tribes the right to have slot machines. And he felt like it was unfair and that if they would have the right to slots, that the card club should have some equal rights to bring slots. And he wanted to bring slots to his Gardena club. And so he's been an advocate of that for a long time. It never came off, but he's been a very successful partner for the city of Gardena. More recently, when the Normandy got into trouble last year, he came in and took over that license and rebranded the club as Larry Flint's Lucky Lady Casino. So he now he's now the godfather of the Gardena card clubs. He's taken the mantle. So it was a tough, sell, but I think he's proven himself there. And I hear now, that he has. It's a tough go to have to run the two clubs. The old club has the Normandy has issues and they're trying to find customers and bring an audience back there by rebranding, but it's a big effort, and I think he has plans of really redeveloping that club and building it up. So it's early days. Time will tell.
The biggest reason for the demise of the Gardena clubs was primarily due to the competition from the other card clubs in Los Angeles County, Hawaiian Gardens, Bell, Bicycle Commerce, and others. When did that happen, And what did the new casinos offer that the Gardena clubs didn't?
Well, it all goes back to the late 70s. I believe those clubs didn't start opening up till 80. But in the late 70s, there was something going on in California with property taxes. They were going up like crazy. There was no cap on the way that property taxes were being raised. And retired people who had bought their homes, in times when you could get a house for, $10,000, $20,000, with the increased taxation of, property tax assessments going up, some of these folks were losing their homes. And so it became a ballot issue. And in 1978, California voters passed Proposition 13, which was designed to return property tax assessments to their 1975 values, and that they would, after that only, raise the annual inflation rates by 2%. And how this ties together with card clubs is that it meant that it rolled back a lot of the tax revenues that cities and local, municipalities were taking in from property owners. So they had to supplement that income somehow. And I suppose by 78, a lot of attitudes about gambling and what it does to the moral fabric of a community to have a card club on the corner had kind of softened, and people were seeing, how the Gardena model had been so successful. Probably a lot of these cities were jealous of the way that Gardena had been so profitable with the clubs and how well it had gone for Gardena. It was a good thing for Gardena. So they decided to pass their own ordinances and start to have card clubs of their own. And this was the very first time that Gardena had any local competition, inside LA County. So the competition, what they offered, was newer and nicer clubs at the time, and they also, these clubs like the Bell Club, that they didn't have the stagnant restrictions that were still very much a part of the Gardena ordinances at the time, which was, like I was describing, no liquor, and you could have your liquor and play at the tables at the new clubs, and the security was also thought to be better at the new clubs, both inside and outside of the clubs. So seniors were saying, in the paper articles, oh, we feel more comfortable playing where at these newer clubs, and the clubs were more modern. And, the Gardena clubs had up until the time kind of taken their position as the only show in town for granted. And so some of these places were literally falling apart. And they, Tom Parks used to tell you, well, we really kind of treated the customers like cattle. Because, we were the only place to go. So we could kind of do it whatever we wanted to the customers, in a sense. There was no, take it or leave it. You had to play in Gardena. So once there was an option, and perhaps some of these people didn't have to drive as far across LA County to go to Gardena anymore if these clubs were closer to them. And, it had a catastrophic effect for Gardena's card club monopoly, because it was almost like a domino effect. Every time a new club would open in LA, a Gardena club would fold, starting in 80 when the Bell Club opens, the Monterey Club closes. And then, 83, Commerce opens, the Rainbow Club closes. 84, you have the Bicycle and Huntington Park casinos opening, then that's when the new Gardena club folded. And then the Horseshoe folds in 89, leaving the Eldorado and the Normandy as the last two operating Gardena clubs. So that's the story. I mean, it was the death of the card clubs for Gardena once there was that outside option.
Our last question. You mentioned Ernie Prim a couple times. 45 miles south of Las Vegas, there's this town called Prim, with Whiskey Pete's and several other casinos there. How are they related to Ernie Prim?
Well, they're the same. It's the same guy. Prim Already Prim bought that land, 400 acres, from the estate of a Texas moonshiner who owned the land. His name was Pete McIntyre, and they bought it from his estate in the 1950s. And at the, you know, the time of Pete McIntyre, it was a little gas station with some slots, and he sold moonshine to anybody that was coming back and forth between Vegas and L.A., so a little road stop. And then Prim really didn't start building up that area much until 1977. There was something there, but he'd come out of retirement after selling his properties off in Reno to the Del Webb Corporation. He had the Prima Donna Club up there, and he owned a lot of property in downtown Reno. So he took a year off after that, and Gardena was, you know, they were always ahead of the curve. He knew that that was going away. So he and his son started to build up what was known at the time as State Line or Border Town. And you know, ever since buying the land in the 50s, Prim had visualized this kind of desert oasis place as a casino area. And I've heard reports about how he had an architect's rendering of a casino standing in the desert on the wall of his office in Gardena for all those years. And he'd tell anybody that was interested, you know, who came to the office, that this was going to be the next big thing. And Blaine Nicholson, who was Ernie Prim's public relations man and publicist, he talked about how Prim had envisioned State Line at one time as being this kind of a resort that he could connect to Gardena through a local airport. He would fly his Gardena customers to the State Line, and they would walk across the State Line and go into his Nevada casino and play all the casino games that they couldn't get in Gardena. But that, you know, that never came off. So, you know, by the 70s, when he was starting to get it going, Prim had to use other measures to get people to come play there. Even though there was a lot of traffic on going through Prim, he had to, you know, even take the measure of paying off bus drivers to stop at Whiskey Pete's and then tell everybody on the bus that the bus had engine trouble, so that they come off, the passengers would come off and then go inside and play while they were supposed to be fixing the bus outside. And then, you know, after Prim died, his son Gary really built up the rest of what became known as Prim Nevada. I believe it was branded Prim Nevada in 96. And, you know, of course, it features Whiskey Pete's, Buffalo Bills, and the Prim Valley Golf Resort and everything. And Gary was involved in the New York casino in Las Vegas, and he with his partners merged the Prim properties in Prim Nevada with MGM Grand Inc. in 1999. And then I hear they were resold again in 2007 to the Affinity Gaming Corporation for $400 million. So it's a terrific windfall. I mean, and I know that, you know, when they renamed it, Gary gave a speech and talked about what an honor it was for the Prim family to have the place named after Ernie. It's a tremendous tribute for, you know, the man who started it all.
Very good. We've been talking to Max Votolato, author of Gardena Card Clubs, A High Stakes History, and also the documentary Freeway City, which covers considerably more than the gambling situation in Gardena. Thank you, Max. It's been very informative. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.